You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Now, recently, we've been bemoaning congressional inaction on protecting sensitive data that Americans give up while using the internet in their day-to-day lives. There have been hearings galore, but not the kinds of results most people hope for. In the last weeks, the president has issued an executive order on preventing access to Americans' bulk sensitive personal data and United States government-related data by countries of concern. That's a mouthful. But here to talk about it and how the president had authority to do this, what the EO covers, and how it's about to change the landscape for some federal agencies is friend of the cast, Alex Joel. Mr. Joel is a professor at the Washington College of Law. He previously served as the Civil Liberties Protection Officer for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, maybe even the first one, right, Alex?
Yes.
Well, we're glad to have you. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
We actually sort of presaged this. We didn't know it was official, but I think it's important to talk about, we're watching this whole unitary executive thing evolve. So what authority did the president base this order on? And yes, I've ended a question with a preposition. So for those of you that care and want to send me an email, please do.
Well, your listeners are very familiar, I believe, with the authority that the president used, which was IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, that was passed in 1977. It's been relied upon many times by all administrations declaring national emergencies in order to justify action by the executive to have a direct impact in regulating commercial transactions, stepping into the commercial sphere to directly impact how our companies and our people in the United States can do business with other countries or other people that are of national security concern. So he relied on IEPA and earlier had declared an emergency, that he relied upon. And I can talk a little bit more about that. I think in order to understand what is happening here, it's helpful to think about the various threats that have been facing the United States and how this fits in as part of that picture. So that's part of what this is about.
Yeah. And I just to refresh listeners' memory, I'm sure most of them know this, but not everyone. Data brokers are people who can acquire all kinds of data from your internet usage. And it does get bundled into something that is sort of an anonymized identity of you for targeted advertising purposes. But those same companies that provide those profiles can sell them to almost anyone presently and do. And many of our guests have expressed concern about this. So what was it in particular that justified this emergency at this time?
So I think it's helpful to think back on the various threats that the intelligence community has been warning about over the last few years. And these threats are specifically cited by the executive order and by other executive materials that have been released. So these include primarily threats to the what they call the information and communications technology and services supply chain, ICTS, and emanating principally from China, which has been named in various intelligence community assessments and warnings as seeking to penetrate and impact U.S. critical infrastructure and obtain data. Those of us in government will remember the OPM breach of many years ago, which was attributed to China and which involved the theft of a huge amount of very sensitive data involving government employees. And there have been other efforts that have been cited by the government to steal large amounts of personal data involving Americans, as well as to penetrate our critical infrastructure. And I think Volt Typhoon is a particular threat stream that has received a lot of attention in recent weeks, which involved China placing capabilities that would enable it to disable or certainly impede the use of critical infrastructure. And the concern was that it would do so in conjunction with some kind of move on Taiwan to disrupt the U.S. ability and willingness to respond. And this was a hugely problematic threat that was discovered and has been addressed. And so I think it's helpful to think of this particular measure as consistent with those kinds of concerns, where the government is worried that China is accessing personal data in a way that would enable it to carry out policies and actions that are adversarial to our national security interest. And one way to think about this, at least one way that I think about this, is this is a recognition that data protection, protecting personal data, goes hand in hand with cybersecurity. Because one of the things that China and other adversarial countries can do with personal data is improve their ability, enhance their ability to penetrate our systems, to obtain classified information, to provide themselves with capabilities that enable them to do things that are going to be problematic for our national security. And it might be to better penetrate a particular system through exploiting personal data in ways that would enable them to get access to that. It could enable them to identify individuals for espionage purposes and recruitment purposes. It also could involve foreign malign influence campaigns. And I'm not making all this stuff up. This was actually in the executive order and in the announcements. On the specific emergency, I think it's helpful to keep in mind that the emergency was actually declared in an executive order back in 2019 on ICTS. This was Executive Order 13873, where President Trump declared an executive order recognizing that foreign adversaries were exploiting vulnerabilities in the information and communications technology and services capabilities of the United States. And this executive order, 14117 by President Biden, expands on that declaration to encompass the efforts of adversary countries to get access to personal information for purposes that go against our national security.
So you're talking about potential critical infrastructure impacts. If they get certain access, it would be to the telecommunications backbone. And traditionally, that has been freezing or eliminating communications in a given country has always been something used at war. And the Nazis cut cables, communication cables, to the UK in World War II. So this is something that is frequently done. The personal data is something that I think may not be apparent, but the amount of information that is held by any telecommunications company on any human being these days is incredible. I think we're all living through our phones almost entirely. So let's talk about precisely what data is covered by this order. As I'm listening to you speak and we talk about sensitive personal data, what comes to mind, of course, is things like medical records, attorney-client communications, you know, just the kinds of things that could be exploited, financial data, financial status. So what is covered by this order? And in your opinion, does it sound inclusive enough at this time?
Great question and a complicated question. And of the ones that you just named, one of them is not covered, which would be attorney-client communications, but the other ones actually are. So it's important to think about this executive order as the first stage. Right. So in the executive order, President Biden is laying the groundwork for further regulatory activity to better define specifically what's going to get regulated and how. So you could tell by the title that you read, it applies, generally speaking, to bulk personal sensitive. I can't remember. Is it bulk personal sensitive data?
Government. Every one of those words is in there.
It's in there somewhere yeah. In some order. Right. So but those are all important words. Right. It's bulk and it's sensitive personal data. So that's one huge category. And the other one is government-related data, which is essentially sensitive data that focuses on specific individuals that could be associated, that are associated with the government, including current and former government employees, or people who are connected to them, where you can see from a national security perspective, you're already thinking, okay, yes, I can understand that. We don't want our intelligence community personnel identified if they don't want to be identified. Sensitive facilities, we don't want them disclosed. So there is no bulk limitation on quote unquote government related data, but there is something on other personal sensitive data or sensitive personal data. So those are the broad categories. In terms of what it actually means, you have to read a separate document, which is actually a very good document. It's called the ANPRM, the Advance Notice of Public Rulemaking, that was issued by the Department of Justice just a few days after the executive order came out. You can see right away when I said Department of Justice, the Department of Justice is the lead agency, but they are working closely with other agencies and government. And in that ANPRM, they lay out how they propose to subdefine sensitive data and what are the bulk kind of parameters we're talking about. Is it 100 records? Is it 1,000 records? Is it 1,000,000 records? Is it 100 million records? right? So they lay out certain parameters that they think of, that they're currently thinking of as ranges, and they want to get public commentary on whether those are the right ranges. I think one way to think about this is to consider that if you're in the government's shoes, if you're in DOJ's shoes and you're trying to regulate this area, there are certain kind of analytic chunks that I think it just helps to break things down into. One is exactly the question you asked, like, what is the data we're talking about? And there are definitions and types, and it gets very complicated. And I'll mention a few of them. You can also exclude certain kinds of data, like, we don't mean this, we're not going to cover this, but we do mean these things. And we mean these things in this amount of quantity. You can also think of what types of transactions and with whom, like, you know, who's on the other end of the transaction that we're worried about. And the executive order and the or the AMPRM uses this term countries of concern, right? So there are certain countries of concern that we're going to be focused on, but not other countries. What are you going to do with those transactions? You can either allow them, you can prohibit them, you can restrict them. And essentially, the Department of Justice is thinking of crafting their proposed rulemaking around prohibiting certain kinds of data brokerage transactions, data brokerage transactions, and then bulk genomic data as well. So bulk genomic data is information that is genetically related information, that information that allows you to figure out all kinds of specific information about an individual based on their genetic information. So you previously had identified health information as something that is sensitive. It's also a category that they've mentioned is health information. They've mentioned financial information as another category. So genomic data would be a subcategory. It obviously is a form of health information, but they are regulating it separately as its own category. Because of the potential risks that they think it poses, it's highly sensitive. It should not be something that is provided in bulk so that an adversary could determine information.
What virus to target us? What would work on the vast majority of Americans?
Could be for that purpose, yes. It also could help fuel biotechnology advances that could be used in ways that we don't consider to be consistent with our national security.
And I would add something, Alex. I think that we are the gold standard because we're a diverse country. You have every race and every ethnicity in this country, immigrants from every continent. And I think if you were looking for data that you didn't possess in your country because you restricted immigration or you didn't have such a diverse population, that you really couldn't develop adequate medical tools, biotechnological tools, unless you understood, you know, sort of the human landscape really look like. And frankly, it's here in the United States of America.
Yes. And I think that's also true not only for genomic data, but also just generally speaking, one of the concerns that is raised in the executive order and in the related documents is around the development of artificial intelligence and how important it is for artificial intelligence to benefit from these large and diverse data sets. And for the concern being here that if China or other countries gain access to huge amounts of Americans' data, they will better fuel their artificial intelligence technology in ways that A, outpace what the US is able to do, and B, can in turn help them carry out activities that we don't think are helpful for our national security.
And we did hear that precise thing in some of the, there were earlier hearings on the Hill regarding the US data sets and how valuable they are, not just for the ethnic diversity of the population, but just the sheer amount of information that is available because of some of the freedoms that we have in place. Let's talk about this. There's going to be sort of some big seismic shifts in terms of what federal agencies are going to be working on, even though some of this stuff has been percolating, somewhat nascent. Can you talk a little bit about how some executive branch agencies are going to see their responsibilities expanded under the CO?
Yeah, I think the primary impact right now is with Department of Justice. So Commerce was made the lead agency in this ICTS executive order that I mentioned earlier that came out in 2019. As a point of interest, and not coincidentally, I think, another ANPRM came out very close to the same time as these other documents did on bulk data. And that was the Commerce ANPRM on connected vehicles. At the same time that the Department of Justice is leading a rulemaking process to better define how they're going to prohibit or limit these kinds of large-scale transactions with quote-unquote countries of concern regarding personal data, Commerce is also soliciting input on how to limit the use of technology from these same countries. So they're working in a coordinated way, trying to address the threats that they see, threats which they think could result in the collection of large amounts of personal data of Americans that could put our national security at risk. So in one process, you've got Commerce in the lead. And in the other process, you have the Department of Justice in the lead. Now, I don't know all the internal reasons why that division came about. One thing I think is interesting for those in your audience who are CFIUS experts or who have some contact with the CFIUS process, I think a lot of what I've been talking about will be very familiar to them, because in CFIUS, back in 2018, Congress enacted FIRMA, F-I-R-R-M-A, the Foreign Investment Risk Review Modernization Act, I believe. And in that statute, they specifically identified sensitive personal data as something they wanted CFIUS to focus on and to assess the risks of in terms of an investment transaction. So in CFIUS, you have a foreign investor looking to acquire a significant stake in a U.S. business. And as one of the areas of potential national security threat, the CFIUS agencies are supposed to look at whether that transaction gives it access to sensitive personal data, which is defined by CFIUS regulations. So you have a whole interagency process focused on that, and it's been criticized because it really just focuses on this inbound investment activity when companies are still free to sell personal data to these other entities or to otherwise provide them access to that data. That, I think, hopefully will help some of your audience understand where this executive order might be coming from, or in part where it might be coming from. If you're working deep in that CFIUS process and you're dealing with investment transactions and you're looking at whether or not different kinds of arrangements in that investment transaction make sense in order to restrict, maybe allow the transaction to go forward, but at the same time restrict access to sensitive personal data as defined by the CFIUS regulations, you're also going to be thinking about, well, wait a minute, you know, we have some gaps here. Let's close these other gaps. Let's put in place a regime that allows us to deal with access to sensitive data as a general matter, not just through an investment transaction under CFIUS. So I think it's going to be a lot more work. For those of your audience who read the ANPRM, it is a great document, in my view, in terms of being very thorough and thoughtful, but it does highlight how many issues there are to figure out. Like defining these data sets, figuring out what the thresholds are going to be, figuring out how are you going to deal with companies that want to license or have exceptions, because that's something that's specifically contemplated. What transactions are going to be allowed to go forward and what aren't? The ANPRM does a great job of laying out some examples and say, well, for example, we mean this should be able to go forward, but not that. So just as an example of what that is all about, one of the categories of transactions that the Department of Justice lays out in this ANPRM are cloud service agreements, vendor agreements, which are going to be, it proposes, would be restricted if with a country of concern, but not prohibited. But not every vendor agreement would fall into that category. So one of the examples they give is, okay, you're a social media company and you're using a cloud hosting provider from China. Okay, well, that cloud company in China is subject to Chinese law, which is very broad and enables the government to come in and demand access to the bulk personal data that the Chinese cloud provider has access to by virtue of its running the back end for the social media company. So they're saying, yeah, that's the kind of vendor agreement we're looking to restrict or prohibit, depending on how it's structured. So they also include employment agreements as a category. And again, it would be, I have a key employee, this employee has access to all the bulk personal data, and that employee is based in a country of concern and is a national of the country of concern. Well, you know, that's similar. The reasoning is similar. You have now opened a door to bulk personal data from that country of concern, and so we need to restrict that. But then you're immediately asking, well, what about, you know, what about American employees in a branch office? What about this? What about that? What about this kind of vendor agreement? It could get very complicated.
Sure. What about call centers that you have got an issue with Citibank on the weekend and you call and there's a call center somewhere unknown, maybe in South Asia.
Right.
And they're suddenly getting access to your account from there. And that's not the only call that we place where there's an offshore call center.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's a great example. Now, they limit it, though, to only certain countries so far. So their intention is to focus on this, quote unquote, countries of concern.
That's kind of fluid, right? I mean, it just depends. So, I mean, right now it's China. Right now, I'm sure Russia is of concern.
Yes.
But, you know, things do change over time. And there are other countries that could follow that slippery slope into autocracy and become more of a menace.
So in their advance notice of public rulemaking, they suggest that they will follow the Department of Commerce's designation of countries of concern, which it did following that ICTS executive order from 2019 that I talked about. They issued a federal regulation, and in that federal regulation, pursuant to that executive order, they identified China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela. So six specific named countries, which I think some might say is both too broad and too narrow at the same time, which I guess government would say, yeah, we got it just right. It's interesting that that's where they went. And I'm not sure, I mean, I think it's evident that each of them does not present the same kind of threat, particularly in the ICTS space. And other countries where maybe there are all kinds of access points to data, you know, are not listed here.
Let's pivot for a second. And I guess the last point on that is any country that's later invaded or has a leader inserted by one of these other countries of concern would then necessarily likely become of greater concern as well.
Yes.
So that's why I say some of this is and can be fluid. Now, let's talk for a second about these large data brokers. We have grown an economy around a particular business model, and Americans are madly in love with free internet access and things that they believe they're not paying for. Now, we've always said all along, you're actually paying for it. You just don't know right now what the cost is going to be. For that little dopamine hit that you get every time you go on social media or get a like on one of your posts. But there is a consequence to these things. As you're doing this free thing, you're giving up all this data, right, to these people who are data brokers, ultimately, although you first give it up to the company you're interfacing with, they then spin together some sort of a profile of you along with billions of others and sell it to individuals who are data brokers, ostensibly for targeted advertising. But we did see this week that one of the larger companies in this space was founded by an individual who had close personal ties to Vladimir Putin. In fact, pictures have emerged of the two of them sitting together as considerably more hirsute young men. I wonder, can you talk about like who these people are? Do we know where the biggest companies are? What is the business model impact for Silicon Valley, since we've really got a tech sector and an economy that has come of age around this sort of invisible exploitation of Americans?
So I think this is a very difficult question because it depends on how you define it, right? So many companies, I would say not just big tech companies, but a lot of companies and the federal government will engage in a commercial transaction to try to get additional information. There's been a number of studies that U.S. government agencies are out there acquiring additional, and the ODNI released a report on this, commercially available information. It's this whole category of collection of data that is available for collection by the U.S. government, subject to certain rules and procedures that they have to follow to protect people's privacy. But so I'll just say definitions matter, and a lot of companies could be in this category. One commonality that definitions have is that it's data that is not collected directly by the company from the individual as a customer or user of that company's service. So some third party that gains access to the data that's collected by another company, by the main company that has the relationship with you. So some of these companies, like, you know, obviously the companies covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act could be viewed as data brokers. I mean, you have large-scale, well-established companies that have been providing information-related services for due diligence and other reasons for decades. And they have established privacy policies. They have chief privacy officers. They have compliance teams. There are huge companies that we all use for legal research and other research purposes. Those companies, and then you have much smaller ones that are not well-known, that do seem to specialize in getting geolocation data or ad data or things that we have not as a society been focused on exactly in the way that you say. And depending on how you write these definitions and which companies you seek to reach, I think you could end up with a whole range of companies in there. So I think that's one of the definitional issues that they're going to have to tackle in the ANPRM. Because right now it's quite broadly defined as companies that essentially aren't the primary, do not have themselves the relationship with the customer. I think a super interesting aspect to this that your question brings up is how does this intersect with the desire to regulate this activity outside of the national security context, but simply as a privacy matter for the U.S., or when you're thinking about the U.S. government and what they're doing and what the U.S. government agency is seeking to do with access to this data. And as you know, there have been a number of legislative proposals, including embedded within some of the FISA 702 reauthorization bills, to limit or restrict or prohibit government access, law enforcement and national security access to data broker data, such that it would require, if the government wanted access to that data, they would have to get some kind of court order or use a subpoena or use some other kind of compulsory legal authority, but they couldn't just buy it.
Yeah, and but I mean, just play devil's advocate to that point, though. Okay, so we restrict the USG from doing that, which is the, you know, most regulated government probably in the world, maybe some other governments in Europe. But the point is that once you have that data as the private company, until this executive order, really, what restricted you from selling it wherever the heck you wanted to all over the world? So any other government could get access to this data, but not our own.
Yes. And it's going to be super interesting to see what happens now with this, because two things I think that come out of this, like one or two interesting questions that pop up in my mind anyway. One is the government's traditional response to attempts to regulate it. It's exactly what you have said, regulate its access to the data. It's like, and I certainly agree with this, like, why would you regulate U.S. government access, but not access by adversaries? And so with this action,
because you're running for office. I don't know.
With this action, the government is in essence saying, okay, we are now regulating foreign adversary access to this data. So I think it raises the question of whether or not it will allow people who want to regulate U.S. government access to come in and do so now that the foreign government access is also regulated.
Well, you should shut the doors to the outside from the house first, right? Before you start shutting the doors inside.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Or, you know, raise the castle gate first.
Right. So they're doing that. And so now the question to me is like, well, what about this other data broker proposals that have been floating around Congress, including in the 702 reauthorization bills? The related point is that it's so interesting reading the ANPRM and the other documents here, because they cite to reports and articles, for example, in the New York Times on the ability to identify data, supposedly anonymized geolocation data, to figure out who the specific individuals are. So they cited to a well-known New York Times article to this effect back in 2019. They cite to a couple of papers written focusing on how data broker information can be used to identify military in sensitive locations. But those same techniques and that same data can be used to identify any American, right? So it's interesting that they are highlighting the risks to data posed by foreign regimes. And I think it's going to fuel additional calls for some kind of action to restrict U.S. government access as well.
It's going to be interesting to watch. It's also going to be interesting to see if Congress will do anything other than the 702 thing, because right now I think that has some political traction. But it'll be interesting to see that if they elect to do it. They finally got the FIRMA, you know, they got FIRMA passed at some point. I don't know if the acrimonious pitch was really at its, you know, acme when they did that, but it would be a positive step and something I think they could take some pride in if they actually did it. So I've raised the issue with you, of course, you know, what are the unintended consequences of this action? You know, one of the things that I wonder about is, you know, reports lately, China's basically working itself off the global internet, according to recent reports. They're trying increasingly to create, you know, sort of this amniotic ecosystem that really is confined in China while harvesting whatever they can from data sets and information around the world. Now, I've talked about the fact that this may have financial consequences to Silicon Valley if this information is being sold abroad more than we realize. Like if most of the data is making its way out of the country or to countries of concern, we may know that in pretty short order. But what are your thoughts about secondary, tertiary consequences of these kinds of EOs? And it doesn't have to be, you know, in terms of national security. There may be, you know, other thoughts that you have on this score, having thought about all this for such a long time.
Yeah. So one of them I've mentioned already, which is, you know, what is it going to do in terms of this kind of legislation on the Hill? I do think this also raises the question of whether this kind of an approach is going to be effective in the long run. So I think the U.S. government is proceeding in a logical way. They've identified a national security threat. They're responding to that threat through the legal tools that are available. As you pointed out, Congress has not very functional these days, is not generating a lot of legislation in this space. In some ways, the administration is using the tools that are available to respond to a very real and pressing concern. So in that sense, I think this is a good thing. I'm glad the government is taking action. I'm glad the government is recognizing that protecting the privacy and confidentiality of Americans' data is a national security concern, and I'm glad they're protecting our data from adversarial exploitation. So I think all of that is good. The question in my mind is this sustainable over the long term, or don't we need, exactly as you were pointing out earlier, a much more comprehensive approach to data governance and technology regulation? Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like it's on the immediate horizon given how Congress is going. Another thing that I know the administration is very focused on and that I'm very focused on is whether or not this is consistent with our overall approach toward an open, interoperable, and secure internet and the free flow of data among like-minded democracies. Can we claim that we're for an open and interoperable internet while at the same time banning certain transactions from certain countries? I think yes. I think it is consistent. I think the idea of data free flow with trust, which is the term that's used in this area, naturally implies that you are sharing data with countries that you trust, and you trust them because of the way their legal frameworks are set up, their democracy is governed by the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. And you have certain countries that you don't trust because they are authoritarian, autocratic regimes which have, you know, sole discretion to access data whenever they want. And there isn't really legal process for dealing with that. So I think it's consistent, but it does raise the question of what kind of a global ecosystem are we moving toward? To me, it highlights the importance of democracies coming together, as I've said in prior podcasts with you, agreeing on norms and acting in a consistent way. Obviously, the U.S. is viewing this from a national security perspective, and I think it's good that we think of data protection now going hand in hand with cybersecurity, going hand in hand with national security. But there are other things that we have to think about in terms of personal data, not just the national security angle, and I hope we get there along with our allies overseas.
And we may. I don't know if he was referencing this, but I did hear today that in a conversation with a journalist about TikTok, even former President Trump said that he would not be in favor of a ban, but he paused for a minute to address the issue of personal sensitive data. So I don't know if he'd been briefed and that was something that he said. But I find it interesting, just in terms of being optimistic about the United States generally, the effort to move in the direction of protecting Americans from this sort of exploitation, their data from this kind of exploitation, has spanned more than one administration of different political parties, and the professionals in the government have worked on this assiduously over time, keeping their eye on the prize and keeping their eye on the national security of the United States and the interests of United States citizens, despite everything that you may see on TV. That's a pretty wonderful thing.
Yes, I agree. Just something just popped into my head as you were talking about TikTok, which is that consistent with what is commonly known as the Berman Amendment, the IEPA authority cannot restrict the transmission of information and informational materials. So First Amendment protected rights are going to continue, and personal communications also cannot be interfered with under IEPA. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Let me give you an opportunity to offer some last thoughts. You give so much more thought to this than almost anybody I know. Is there anything else that you're thinking about with respect to this move forward with this EO that you think our listeners would like to know about?
Well, I encourage people to read the ANPRM. And if they're interested or they're concerned that their clients might be impacted, you know, there are very well-written examples there that make it very clear what the government is getting to. As you go through those examples and as you read through the ANPRM, I have no doubt that you will have comments or thoughts. I believe that the government is honestly and in good faith, you know, eager to get people's reactions and responses. They're trying to make this doable. I do worry that the enforcement and compliance load is going to be very significant. I think this is going to be a difficult area for the government to regulate. The enforcement and compliance load is going to be super interesting. They're not requiring additional reporting. They're not requiring anything in particular other than as it relates to specific license applications that they might get.
Not yet. But there have to be individuals to receive that information and take enforcement actions. And, you know, some of these agencies may or may not have adequate staff for that purpose.
That's exactly right. Yes. So I, you know, as those of us, for me, I was in government, you're still there. This is going to take staff, time, effort. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I do encourage your listeners, if they're interested, to submit comments.
And I guess we can hyperlink that in the notes to the cast, which would make it even easier. All right. Well, it's always great to talk to you. I really appreciate it. And we hope to see you again soon, because there are a few other things on the horizon that I know are right in your wheelhouse. Take care. And thank you for listening to National Security Law Today. If you want to find us on social media, you can at the handle at ABANATSEC. Of course, you can always send us an email at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org. Make sure you share this podcast with a friend. Have an intelligent discussion about the issues that I've discussed today with Alex Joel. And remember to hear other people's points of views. One of the greatest things in terms of our national security is our unity. We've emphasized in this podcast how we're sought after. Our data sets are sought after because of our diversity. It's not just our ethnic diversity, it's our diversity of thought, which is a luxury in some places or doesn't exist. Thanks for listening tonight. Your writer and producer is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham of Brooklyn. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, who is tireless, freakishly so. She's kind of amazing, as well as all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. See you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.